our people from the earlier panel that you might invite to sit there, if you see what I mean. Yeah. She probably, yeah, tell her, she doesn't, she may not want to, but I think we should, we're going to have Casey's seat empty, and Charlie Johnson, I think, for it. Morning, Dave. We brought all these people together just so you could say hello to them again. Well, maybe we could begin to assemble. Please sit here if you like. I think okay. Yeah. Doric, I think John has decided he's going to sit over there. Well, why don't you take his name tag over there? Yes, that's a good idea.
Where is
it? It's right there. Please sit wherever you wish, but take your name tag with you because this is being televised, and it would be a shame if your remarks appeared under someone else's name. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome you to this morning's session of the Alaska Native Review Commission. My name is Tom Berger, and I have been appointed by the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the World Council of Indigenous People to conduct this review. The proceedings this morning are being televised by Learn Alaska and the Alaska Independent Television Network and the North Slope Borough Television Network, if that's what it is. And that's why we have the name cards. And it means that as we proceed, we will want to make sure that the name cards are in place. The proceedings are also being recorded by the Commission so that a transcript can be prepared and so that there will be a permanent record of what is said. And for that reason, I may take the liberty of mentioning your name before you speak. If you would do so yourselves, that would be very, very helpful, so that when the typist comes to make her transcript, she will have the benefit of knowing who it is who is speaking as we move along. And I should say, for the benefit of the audio and the television and the typist, that a reference was made yesterday to Julius Brecht that I described at the time as inappropriate, and I'm directing that remark, which had nothing to do with the proceedings of the time, be stricken from the record, and that it not be typed, and that it not appear on television or on audio. That, I may say, is to protect all, and I do mean all concerned. Now, we began these overview roundtable discussions on Monday of this week, and Anne Phenup Reardon, an anthropologist here at the university, presented a paper on what she called the spirit of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. And she went through the testimony given at congressional hearings held back in the late 60s and tried to extract the basic themes that emerged from consideration of those materials. And we have, with some of those who represented Alaska Natives at the time, discussed what it was Alaska Natives were trying to achieve in those days. And I think everyone agreed that Anne Reardon's paper had fairly highlighted what it was Alaska Natives were trying to achieve, that is, to protect and preserve ancestral lands so that they could continue in use and occupation of those lands, to acquire cash compensation for economic development, to resolve past social ills and full participation in the future of Alaska, the achievement of self-sufficiency and self-determination, and continuity and cultural integrity. I mention those things. During the discussion, it was suggested by a number of those who had represented Alaska Natives at the time that self-rule or sovereignty had not been addressed in those days. It was also suggested that the right of Alaska Natives exploit the waters of Alaska and of offshore Alaska had not been addressed by the Claims Act. Some of those who spoke suggested there were flaws in the Claims Act. It was acknowledged that the Claims Act was a landmark achievement, that it served as the means of holding and consolidating 44 million acres of native lands. The village and regional corporations served as well as the means for assembling and disposing of and investing the $962.5 million that were received under the settlement. And it was acknowledged, I think, that the corporations had given Alaska Natives economic influence and flowing out of that political influence in the state unprecedented before ANCSA. The speakers did suggest there were flaws in the act. The question of transferability of shares, of course, leads to the possibility of loss of control of the corporations by native shareholders and thereby a loss of ancestral lands held by the corporations. It was felt by many that the liability of the land to taxation by the state 20 years after conveyance could turn out to be a very, very serious impediment to Native people retaining their ancestral lands. I can tell you that in the villages of Amonok and Tununuk, where I began the village meetings last week, the opinion was virtually unanimous, as it was around this table earlier in the week, that the act was flawed in that Native persons born since 1971 do not share in the settlement. Certainly, they do not share as shareholders, but only by inheritance of their parents' shares. Those features of the act are well known and have been very much the subject of discussion in any event. It was suggested, I think, that the goals of Alaska Natives have not changed remarkably over the last 12 years, and there is, I think, a feeling in Alaska, certainly among Alaska Natives today, that the time is appropriate to review what was achieved in 1971 and to consider in what directions Alaska Natives might proceed now. Well, that doesn't do justice to the discussion of the last 3 days, but it's the best I can do at the moment to bring those of you up to date who were not able to be with us. Today, Walter Parker is going to open the proceedings with a commentary on institutions and legal regimes arising from the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and the Alaska National Interest Land and Conservation Act. Might I introduce Mr. Parker and say a word about the rest of you, if you will forgive me, for the benefit of those others present, so that I don't have to go into a long introduction each time we come to one of you. Walter Parker is an historian, economist, served on the staff of the Federal Field Commission, served as Commissioner of Transportation in the Alaska State Government, and was state co-chairman of the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission. David Hickok was on the staff of the Federal Field Commission and serves today as director of the Arctic Environmental Information and Data Center at the University of Alaska. John Havelock is an attorney, was Attorney General of Alaska during the Egan administration, is now Professor of Justice at the School of Justice, University of Alaska, Anchorage. Mr. Roy Hundorf, whom I hope will be joining us later, is President of the Cook Inlet Regional Corporation. Mr. Charles Johnson, whom I hope will be joining us later, is President of the Bering Straits Regional Corporation and Chairman of the Alaska Federation of Natives. Mr. Doug Jones was an economist with the Federal Field Commission, is now Professor, School of Public Administration, Ohio State University. Mr. Guy Martin is an attorney, served as legislative assistant to Congressman Begich at the time of ANCSA, served as Commissioner of Natural Resources here in Alaska, and served during the Carter administration as an assistant secretary at the Department of Interior. Mr. William Van Ness is an attorney in Washington, D.C., was at the time of ANCSA counsel for the Senate Interior Committee, and has served as counsel to the North Slope Borough and the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. Mr. Byron Mallott was mayor of Yakutat and served as executive director of Rural Community Action Program, commissioner of Community and Regional Affairs here in Alaska, and is today the president of Sea Alaska Corporation. Mr. John Borbridge was at the time of ANCSA president of the Tlingit and Haida Central Council. He has served as president of Sea Alaska Corporation, and he is working now on a book on the land claims movement in Alaska. Mr. Roy Ewan was active in the land claims movement, and he is from the Atna region. Mr. Frank Peterson of Kodiak has had a long involvement in the land claims movement. Mr. Alfred Starr of Nanana, who was with us the last 3 days, has been active in the land claims movement perhaps for a longer time than any person in Alaska, and his experience is perhaps without equal. Mr. Joe Upixin, who will, I think, be joining us later, was president of Arctic Slope Native Association at the time of ANCSA. Mr. Don Wright, who has been with us the last 3 days and will, I think, be joining us again, was president of the Alaska Federation of Natives at the time of ANCSA. And Mr. Fred Paul, who has been with us these last 3 days and will, I think, be joining us again, followed his father in the cause of native land claims and served as legal advisor to a number of the organizations that pursued their claims in the late 60s and early 70s. Having disposed, I think, of all of the preliminaries, perhaps, Walt, I could ask you, Mr. Walter Parker, to begin with the discussion that we're going to have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The seems strange after all these years to be back in this familiar setting, sitting with my back to the audience facing the panel up there, but I'm sure after a few moments it will seem like I had never left. The point that I tried to make in the paper, which and I won't even begin to try to cover all the points that I handled in the paper, but the main thing was to try to establish a very general, and as I said, make some tentative observations about the scope of what was done in ANCSA and in the Lands Act and ELCA to affect the future of Alaska Natives in their relationships with the state of Alaska and with the United States. And I think the main thing that I was trying to focus on and kept coming back to is that in using the conveyance of land and the conveyance of monies through any institutions, whether through the corporate institutions as we did in the claim settlement or any others, you're only affecting a part of a person's relationships with the governments that he lives with throughout his life, and trying to define whether the existing institutions can continue to play the major role that many thought they were going to play in defining the future, or whether they we need to think about any future institutional developments by either the Congress or the state of Alaska. I have not attempted in any way to expand beyond the federal-state framework, because I think that's going to come much later in this inquiry, any developments that may come up in that regard. So I'm going to skip all of the preliminary bit dealing with how the lands were allocated and so forth. And if anybody has any questions on those, we can come back to them. But in approaching this, I tried to approach it from a very different perception than that I had had when I was acting as either a state or a federal official in dealing with these matters, and went back to my own long-term relationships with many Alaska Native families throughout the state, and how I had, you know, over the past 37 years, and how I had viewed their particular priorities just as they had developed in our personal relationships together. And so the list of priorities as I developed them on page 5, I think, is very similar to the ones that were in Ms. Reardon's previous paper, but stated in a different manner. And then taking those priorities and relating the institutions that serve those priorities in the rest of the paper as best I could in this in a fairly limited paper. As all of us who dealt with these two acts long since realized, it is very difficult to take something as extremely complex as what is represented within the geographical limits of Alaska and the very diverse peoples who live there, and compress them within a single act. That's why, of course, the Lands Act wound up to be such a voluminous and controverted and extremely legalistic piece of legislation, one which we're still working our way through, as we're indeed working our way through ANILCA. That points out the fact that we will be dealing with the results of these two acts in a very intensive manner, at least till the turn of the century, and certainly, hopefully, in a less intensive manner from then on. But the implementation of what was generated by both ANCSCA and ANILCA is not going to be accomplished overnight, and the needs that were hoped to be satisfied there are continuing needs that are going to have to be satisfied on a continuing basis, and the desires that were created are not going to be satisfied overnight, because the federal and the state government are going to have to, you know, act as they've done in the past in some kind of comprehensive manner to meet those desires, as long as they have the governmental responsibility for satisfying those. Now that, it's also important to therefore pay very real attention as to how those two governments are going to satisfy those local institutions that are set up to satisfy those desires, whether those be local governments or whether those be the corporations or whatever new institutions. In any case, as I viewed the priorities, and I'll briefly review them here, I've always viewed, from the many Alaska Natives who I've known through the years, that the family and village stability and protection were the primary priority, as they are indeed for any rational individual. And that these, the difference being that village stability, for those who live in the urban environment, is no longer something to which they can relate unless they're lucky enough to live in a very stable community or a very stable neighborhood. But it was a great advantage that Alaska Natives had, is that the villages still existed and that could still be related to as a primary institution. So the next priority was the education of the young, which again is very different from, a little different from most people in dealing with their lives. The Next one, cultural rights. There is a somewhat of a diversion in that those of us who live within the framework of what is loosely termed the majority or the accept our cultural rights for granted. It's only when you're in the minority that you don't accept them for granted and have to make them a priority. And during the involvement of the two acts, of course, subsistence and everything that relates became to developed as a major need and desire that had to be satisfied over the long term. I've separated land ownership and economic development from village stability because that was simply recognizing that land ownership is only one of the ways in which we achieve stability in our lives, and economic development is only one of the ways, and indeed land ownership and economic development, I put them together because in the context of Western society and Western law, they do go together. The education of adults, which includes educating adults to take a wider range of jobs, I listed as the next priority. And the last, political participation in state and national government. And the caveat I inserted was that the above desires in the village were a seamless web and there was no conscious ranking. And the reason that there was, the reason they needed to be ranked eventually was because of the requirements of Western society and Western law, which because of the adversarial relationships in which the legal system is cast and the necessity of legislatures and the Congress to create budgets requires a system of prioritization. And so I'd like those things that I listed to be viewed in that the prioritization is imposed and not something that is desired. I won't go into the federal and state record particularly, except to point out that in the past, when the two governments have operated best, they have been reasonably cooperative, despite all of the surface furor and bickering which went on during the settlement acts. There was a good deal of behind-the-scenes cooperation, which most people in this room had some sense of, and that it's necessary to retain that and, you know, stop the shifting of responsibilities back and forth, which are always a part of the federal-state relationship in this country, but which seem to become more intensive when you get down to dealing with the needs of individuals. I think the most important point there as that in the passage of ANCSCA, the long-term implications of the fact that the corporation and the land ownership by the corporations were institutions that were governed primarily by state sovereignty and control did not receive a great deal of discussion throughout the state at that time. And the implications for that since, of course, have become very clear to everybody who has to deal with it, and nobody knows better than Alaska Natives how the ongoing attitudes and workings of the state bureaucracy can influence their abilities to implement what was hoped for in ANCSCA and in the ANILCA amendments. And I said, in viewing the future, the immediate future of the critical years after 1991 and the long-term future of the next 50 years or more, or the way in which I would hope that most administrators and policymakers would view these. However, neither the federal nor state institutions well lend themselves to taking this particular view of policy development. And if you don't have a senior member in the Senate who can stay in the U.S. Senate, who can, or in the state Senate, who can stay with you for a long, long term, or a senior member in the lower bodies, in the House, and either the state House or the federal House, why, it is very difficult to do it within the bureaucracy, because the bureaucracies, of course, in most cases, react to their four-year cycles. And if you don't find that that bureaucracy, which is supposed to provide continuity between administrations, is working satisfactorily, why, you probably should strongly think of creating a new one, or trying very hard to remake the old one in a better mold. And the federal bureaucracies will be just in their relationship to American Indians and Alaska Natives will be discussed very intensively later, but the role of the state bureaucracies is something that, because it is very new, in which there is not an intensive written history and not a great deal of documentation of an analysis of how well the state of Alaska is doing its job in this particular respect. In going through the priorities, I probably missed some of the institutions which I viewed as affecting and hopefully supporting the priorities as I laid them out. In family and village stability and protection, why, the state offers certain options in the first and second class cities in the boroughs, which have been availed, which many villages have availed themselves of. And federally chartered governments and organizations, the traditional council, the IRA council, are other options that have been used intensively and in many cases simultaneously with the state options. And in achieving a satisfactory relationships between those two and the senior bureaucracies, which are supposed to support them, is the key to a lot of successful resolution of the day-to-day problems of Alaska Natives or any citizen of the United States or the state of Alaska. And I think that it pays not to lose sight of that as we get into long-term developments, and not to make any step rapidly which is going to cut off major support in education, health, or any other, police or any other area. And I think that that kind of care is being taken in most cases. But I think it's an area where we can concentrate a great deal more, in which it is possible to make substantial improvements in the way in which we do business without getting into major confrontation, certainly between the federal and state government, and or in requiring either major legislative action by either the Congress or the state legislature. In the education of the young, I think that, you know, it's one of the more exciting areas in Alaska at the moment, especially in the rural areas. It's, there are so many things going on out in the REAAs and the other school districts in the rural areas that it is very difficult to keep track of them. The education of Alaska Native youth in the urban areas is very much in a state of flux at the moment. But I think that some of the things that have been done by the state of Alaska in this area you know, have been meritorious. Obviously, some things have not been, but I would hope that nothing that happens in the future would, in effect, turn off the support that was evinced for rural education in the past, and which hopefully will develop. I mean, you know, in something that is new as the what is going on in rural education in Alaska, where the teacher corps, the long-term teacher corps that will hopefully serve it, has not even been developed yet substantially, is something that we simply need to maintain our past priorities on and enhance them. I think the in comparing it, as we have done in the past, to the education of Alaska Natives to that of Greenlanders, Laps, Canadian Inuit and Indians and others, why that we can learn a great deal from what has happened in those countries about how educational institutions can operate in a separate cultural context without being outside the mainstream of the educational system in whatever country they operate. And there is an area that I think the University of Alaska and everybody concerned with education in Alaska could pay a good deal more attention to than they have in the past. Not that they haven't paid attention to it in the past, but it's an area where a good deal more needs to be paid. Cultural rights, including subsistence, and working out that over the long-term future and tying it to the future of Alaska wildlife, Alaska fisheries, something that simply both the federal and state government are, if subsistence is going to have any meaning, they will have to make it a true priority, and the acceptance of subsistence by the mobile urban populations in Alaska is not going to be achieved easily. We all know that, but the fact that there has been, as reflected in the action on our at the last election, has been some reasonable acceptance in some urban areas is to me a harbinger of some hope for the future, that this particular element can be worked out so that the utilization and regulation of fish and game in Alaska is supportive of the cultural desires of Alaska Natives for the long-term future. And it was without doubt the most difficult thing to deal with in the Lands Act. The if we had tried to deal with it, of course, in the claim settlement, why we'd probably be still be trying to work it out. But it was possible to achieve some legislation during the Lands Act at both the state and federal level, and taking that legislation and fine-tuning it and making it a living body of law is something that I hope will be much more, continue to be much more of a political expression rather than getting mired down in narrow legalisms, because I don't think that Alaskan wildlife or Alaska Natives can live with a narrowly legalistic system over the long term as far as the control of the wildlife. Usually where that has happened in other locations, why simply the wildlife and those who live closest to it have suffered. In land ownership, the only point I tried to make there is that land ownership within the Western context simply gives you rights to use of the land, which are exclusive to yourself, and that the ultimate sovereignty and actual ownership of the land does rest in the United States with either the state or federal government. And of course, we do have a good deal of protection and that the government can't take it away from us without going through due course, but the government's legal rights to the land when they want to use it are pretty clearly expressed. And certainly in Alaska, why the dialogue between all citizens and the state and federal government over what the rights of the private landowner have been somewhat hectic and will continue to be, whether the rights of the private landowner are those of Sohio and Arco, or whether they're the rights of an allotment owner of a 5-acre, 160-acre allotment, the only advantage being that he who can, you know, hire the largest legal staff in our system usually has his land rights most clearly expressed. And that's the way it works in the United States, and indeed throughout everywhere that where the system is based on the English common law concepts of land ownerships, which we largely transferred in the United States. I don't want to make that too simplistic. There's major differences between Canada and the UK and the United States, but still the basic concepts are much the same. In the try to make a few points on land speculation, which I don't view as being a problem for many corporations, but which, of course, for those who have close relationships with the urban areas, how they will handle land speculation in the future will certainly be critical to how their traditional lifestyles developed. At the UN Conference on Habitat, why land speculation was identified as the greatest threat to cultural survival in urban and urban fringe areas throughout the non-developed world, and it will probably work the same in Alaska. But I did make the point that Alaska Natives in most cases are well buffered from those forces at the moment. For how long remains to be seen. If the state is true in its newest population analysis that we have indeed acquired another 56,000 people in the past year, why, those buffers may be eroded rapidly. The education of adults is something that we've tried in the past several years to give a good deal of attention to. Several elements in the university, several elements in the Department of Education. Many of the nonprofit corporations have put enormous effort into the education of adults in Alaska. And all I can say in that is that, you know, we need to continue it, and a great deal more remains to be done, and we need to develop means and institution which will make it as easy as possible for all adult Alaska Natives, and indeed all adult Alaskans who need continuing education to get it, whether it's by a direct tutoring or telecommunications or any other means. Finally, political participation in state and local government, that is something that is pretty clear cut. If Anchorage, you know, got most of those 56,000 people who came to Alaska, as probably they did, why, that means that they will continue to gain a House seat just about on a one per year basis. And well, it'll start declining because the percentages will change, and get a Senate seat every 4 years. And that, of course, for those whose major interests in the legislature are rural interest, is not bode well for the future, but that is a driving force in policy in Alaska, which cannot be eliminated or looked around. The in-migration into Alaska, we do keep some statistics on it. I think the most critical area is to just accept that the state of Alaska is probably going to be a very attractive goal, and that in-migration is going to continue. And sensitizing new Alaskans to what has gone on here in the past, why the state operates the way it does, and sensitizing them to the needs of Alaska Natives and to the rights of Alaska Natives, both those expressed legal rights and the historic rights, which it's, we found difficult, if not impossible, to express in legislation, getting back to the rights to subsistence and so forth, sensitizing to them to that through the media, through our educational system, through every other means of delivering information as possible, is to me one of the keys in working out a successful social future for the state of Alaska. And working out the relationship between conservatism and liberalism, I don't think that's near as important as simply working out a true sensitivity between the urban and rural areas in this state. And if I had it all to do over again, I would begin working on that much earlier in the game than we began it. So in summation, it's my belief that, you know, the state of Alaska is more of a key in the future than federal action in working out the political and economic options for the future of Alaska Natives. Part of this is due to the fact that the state is simply going to have more financial resources available to it than the federal government is going to do to devote to Alaska's specific problems. And the other is simply that Alaskan priorities will, over the long term, get lost in Washington as they have in the past, and that it was a particular fortuitous circumstance of history that the priorities came together as well as they did in the period between 1965 and 1981, well, I should say 66 when the land freeze was implemented and 81 when the Lands Act was passed. And I think that the United States is probably going to have its self occupied with a good deal of things that are much closer to the seat of government in the next 20 years. And